We heard from you asking for more solutions-oriented conversations with a nonprofit called Project Drawdown. We have their scientists to brief us on their latest Climate Poverty Connections report here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It identifies ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while lifting people out of extreme poverty across the world. Join in on getting to Drawdown and a day when we see carbon reductions. 800-642-1234. Paul West is Special Projects Director for Project Drawdown, focused on how climate solutions can conserve biodiversity and improve human well-being. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Great. And we also have Yusuf Jamil, who is an environmental scientist and research associate with Project Drawdown, working at the intersection of climate and poverty. Yusuf, welcome to you as well.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, Yusuf, starting with you, economic growth usually correlates more with pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. What is the challenge for people as we look to curb greenhouse gas emissions and boost the economy and help people out of poverty?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest challenge we see here is that developmental outcomes generally lead to increase in greenhouse gas emissions, as we have seen in the developed countries, right? As we see the economy grow and people growing out of poverty, our greenhouse gas emissions kept on increasing. But what we have shown in this report is that in many developing countries, we can boost economy, help people get out of poverty without increasing greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, Paul, you know, some of that pushback to aggressively implement climate change mitigation measures is that it will have a negative impact on the economy, on working people. Can you explain how you see that differently?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's not as simple as it being either or. Is that our climate, our jobs, and nature and water, human well-being are all part of a system, and certainly our work on climate change it is not going to solve all of our problems. However, oftentimes if we are working on energy and our food system and transportation, that work on climate solutions is a pathway toward a better economy and people's livelihoods.
Yusuf, you know, as you look at the new report, it says the number of people living in extreme poverty declined over the past 25 years. Why do you see it falling?
Yeah, and one of the main reason why it has fallen is there is a concerted effort to help people who are in poverty to get out, either through economic measures, through education, and there have been a lot of focus in developing countries to make this happen, you know, through several projects focused on people living in extreme poverty to help them out. And one of the key thing here is that we have seen that extreme poverty has declined tremendously in China, in India, in other South Asian countries, and we have seen an increase in job growth. But the same has not been seen in sub-Saharan African countries, where the percentage has declined in extreme poverty, but due to the increase in population, the absolute number has kind of remained constant or in fact increased a little bit. So it's very important here right now that, that we focus on region specific, how poverty has declined in each region. So where we have seen very huge gains in Asian countries, similar gains in African countries have not been seen. And it is all linked to, as I said, economy, politics, the regional stability, the job market. And in countries where these things have been mostly positive, we have seen a decline in poverty, but whereas in other places, we have not seen similar declines.
So it's very much region specific as you look across the world. Yeah. As to what's going on.
Yeah.
Yusuf Jamil with us. Paul West, they're co-authors of a new Project Drawdown report. It's called Climate Poverty Connections, looking at how the world can fight both poverty and climate change at the same time. You can join in with your observations, your questions, 800-642-1234. Mary Kay is with us from Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I have seen many, many jobs that are open, only there's no transportation to get there. And that means there's a lot of people that are looking for work, but they can't apply because they can't get there. So transportation is the problem.
Mary Kay, thank you for that. Paul, can you address that piece, transportation, and what you see there?
Sure. A big climate solution is improvement in mass transportation, as well as having our cities and towns be more walkable and bikeable. The way we are set up in the U.S. As of now and into the future, I'm sure, is centered around our automobiles. And what that ends up being is that we have a large amount of sprawl, and that means a higher amount of transportation for a part of the population, whereas others have a harder time getting around in town for a job or schooling or to visit family and friends, as your caller had mentioned.
Yes. And so, Yusuf, when you look at transportation and issues that you're seeing in other parts of the world, how does that inform how we see it here in a wealthy country, in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, transportation in developing countries really vary, and I can speak for India because I'm from there. So generally transportation is well connected in and around urban areas, India especially, and some other developing countries have spent a lot of money and resources in improving transportation around urban areas. So, within 50-100 kilometers or, around 70 miles of each big city, you have good public transportation, that connect people and allows them to go in, go out. But the bigger challenge is generally for rural communities, and sometimes it can take hours for them to, just travel 50 miles, 3-4 hours, depending upon, the road service, the kind of bus or train service do they have. So it's very regional dependent, depending on the economic activity of that state or that region in the developing countries. And the other point I would like to highlight is, again, the kind of transportation people have access to. Sometimes, the technologies are old, right? So they could be polluting. And, especially once again, in large cities, in most of the developing countries, right, we have this huge air pollution, health problem relating, arising due to, very bad air quality, a lot of which also is contributed from transportation. So the challenges are different, but I guess people improve transportation, where it's run mostly on clean energy would help everyone across the world.
We have environmental scientist Yusuf Jamil, ecologist Paul West with us. They're from Project Drawdown. Their latest report looks at climate solutions that can alleviate hunger and improve lives across the globe. Join in on what you wonder about. What are win-win solutions to climate and poverty? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Project Drawdown here on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with Drawdown Lift on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Born out of Project Drawdown, launched last year to deepen the work around climate change solutions that alleviate poverty around the globe so that people most impacted by the climate crisis have the tools, have the resources required to adapt, and they recommend taking action on 28 climate poverty solutions. Add your voice, 800-642-1234. Paul West is Project Drawdown Special Projects Director, and Yusuf Jamil is Research Manager for Drawdown Lift. They're with us for the hour. So, Paul, the World Bank says about 80% of the world's poor work in agriculture. That's roughly 800 million people. Why are the poor concentrated in the agriculture industry?
Well, a good part of that is that a lot of the agriculture in that situation is for subsistence farming, and so what is grown is eaten directly by the farmers, and not as much sold as markets other than in town or in cities that are in that area.
So it's growing the food and then consuming it directly. So living off the land essentially is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. And certainly there is an irony that most of the poverty and food insecurity is in areas where almost all the people are farmers. So in rural areas in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And what we have looked at is that there are a number of climate solutions that improve our climate, as well as offer opportunities to increase the amount of food that's grown, which then is able to lead to more food at the household level, as well as increased income. And then that then has a spillover effect, is that especially in cases where women are involved and have a say in what is grown and what is sold, and the finances in the house, is that more of that additional income is spent on housing, education, and health. So then that ends up being sort of, I would say, a snowball effect, but of course, in hot and dry areas, that doesn't make sense. But essentially, it builds upon itself. So if there are like a set of strategies on improving the health of the soil, that ends up soaking up more carbon out of the atmosphere. And then that additional amount of organic matter holds a lot more water and nutrients, which is able to improve yields, as well as that extra water that's held in the soil serves as a bit of a buffer in a dry spell, mm-hmm. if not an extreme drought.
Along the lines of food, let's go to Tim in Middleton. Tim, hi, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I just had a question for the guests, if they could address also the greenhouse gas emissions that are caused by animal agriculture and dairy, and if they have any recommendations for dietary changes worldwide that would help. I've heard estimates of anywhere from 18 to 22% of greenhouse gases are from animal agriculture. I'll take my answer,
Tim,
off the air.
Yes, Tim, thank you. Yusuf, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Tim. And, you know, reducing food waste is a very, very strong solution when it comes to, you know, mitigating greenhouse gas emissions, you know, and that includes, you know, not wasting food, but also includes, you know, changing our diet. So, you know, in the US, it's estimated that 1/3 of the food is generally not consumed. And if we imagine how much greenhouse gas is emitted while growing this food, you know, through the supply chains and everything, and eventually throwing them in the landfills, it's almost criminal. And if we reduce food waste, you know, if we consume food that we buy, it could really contribute tremendously in our fight against climate change. You know, I'll give an example from France that recently banned grocery stores or from wasting their food, and generally they are sent to nonprofits, you know, where they're distributed among the needy. So it's a great way forward to reduce food waste and also fight climate change, and and provide food to people who are hungry. On the other aspect of your question, absolutely, you know, the science is pretty solid that if we consume food that's high in carbon intensity, what it means is, like animal protein, beef, pork, goats, it generally leads to much higher greenhouse gas emissions. So if we switch to more plant-based diet, where we switch our meatballs with, let's say, falafel or chickpeas, they're both protein, and it could really help us a lot in our fight against climate change. So yeah, reducing food waste and changing our diet will go a long way in fighting climate change. And it's one of the most powerful solutions to which all of us can contribute, in our personal capacity.
Paul, what's coming up for you as you really do focus on agricultural methods?
Yeah, well, in response to Tim as well, is that, as he said, about a fifth or a quarter even of our emissions around the globe are from agriculture. And so what we eat and what we waste and how our food is grown has a huge impact on our climate. And the good news is that since we all eat, our choices as individuals have an impact on that. Some of the biggest areas of where the emissions are from in agriculture is about half of them are from deforestation in the tropics. And most of that land, at least in South America and in Southeast Asia, is used for just a few commodities. So it's soy and beef in South America, and in Southeast Asia, it's oil palm. And when you look at what is happening, say in Brazil, is that even all the crops that are grown, say if it's soy, most of that is used as feed for beef in Brazil and Argentina, say Uruguay, or it is shipped overseas and largely is feeding a lot of pigs and chickens in China. And certainly what we see here in the US is while we are growing a lot of corn, a very small amount of that ends up on our plate. So a lot of it is used as feed and fuel. So it's feeding our cows and cars. Certainly we have a tradition here in Wisconsin, where I am based, that agriculture is a huge part of our economy.
Yes.
It's our bread and butter. I mean, it was literally a pat of butter on my bread this morning on toast. So agriculture, again, is a source of the impact, but it's also a source of a solution as well. And it's not to say that we shouldn't eat any meat at all, but maybe what we could shift more to is to see meat more as like a treat. And so maybe you have like a burger on Packer Sundays or a steak on your birthday or anniversary, but it's not necessarily a portion of every meal every day.
It's not a staple of the diet, looking more for plant-based options. We're talking with Paul West, Global Solutions Initiative Director for Project Drawdown. Yusuf Jamil is with us, Drawdown Lift Research Manager, as they brief us on their nearly 100-page solutions-oriented report on climate and poverty. You can join in on the points, 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation on climate change, on poverty, and the work of Project Drawdown after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Project Drawdown back on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The United Nations Global Network Against Food Crises released new numbers Wednesday on people facing acute hunger and malnutrition. The number of people without enough food to eat hit an all-time high last year. David Beasley leads the UN World Food Program, said 276 million people are marching towards starvation in the breadbasket of the world.
If we don't get ahead of this thing, we will have not just famine in multiple countries around the world, because, you know, we've got additional droughts and all types of issues, but you will have destabilization of some nations and you'll have mass migration by necessity. And no one wants that.
Join in on solutions to poverty that intersect with climate, 800-642-1234. We have Paul West and Yusuf Jamil, their research scientists with the nonprofit climate solutions group Project Drawdown, and they're here for the hour. Yusuf, Project Drawdown found how the poor cook is enormously impacting climate and human health. Can you explain how most of the world's poor cook their food?
Yeah. cooking is integral to all of our life, right? But you'd be surprised to hear that almost 2.6 billion people cook food using solid fuels. And what it means is they cook using firewood or cow dung or leftover residue crops. So they don't have access to clean cooking. And that's a big issue. And there are two fundamental issues associated with it. The first is, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, when you used solid fuels, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions are much higher. And it's estimated that about 2 to 2.5% of the total greenhouse gas emissions that we see are because of using, unclean cooking fuels, which includes like firewood and so on. And the other problem is, which is much bigger perhaps in our day-to-day life, is the associated challenges that it brings. For example, every year, about 4 million deaths are associated with household air pollution that arrives due to unclean cooking. So when people are using these fuel woods, cow dungs, crop residue. And on top of that, it also leads to time poverty, because a lot of times, family, and this includes mostly children and women, have to venture out in forest, to collect this firewood. It takes a lot of time and effort from their end. And that really, stops them from pursuing economic activities, or for children, going to school. So the effect is tremendous. Not only it is causing, challenges in terms of climate, but it's also affecting people to actually get out of poverty, because they just don't have enough time, to pursue other activities. So it's a very, very powerful and important solution that these people are provided with much more cleaner form of cooking that we use here in the developed countries. And that could really play a tremendous role, not only in addressing climate change, but also, improving the fundamental, basic life of these people.
What are alternatives to using wood or coal for cooking, and what about access to these alternatives?
That's a great follow-up question. And I think, the alternative is using cleaner form of cooking. So the best would be, clean electricity. But again, that's a challenge to provide to everyone. Even in the U.S., a lot of us are using gas for cooking. So, moving just from solid fuel to more liquid fuel. So, liquefied petroleum gas is a good one. Where, I understand that it is a fossil fuel-based fuel source, but it's still just this transition itself can lead to a tremendous drop in pollution, in greenhouse gas emissions, as well as improve the quality of the life. And access, again, clean cooking has been a major solution, but, it has seen some roadblocks in implementations. And again, it's an area that's actively researched, where solutions are oriented towards local needs, toward what the family wants, So people, researchers are now engaging with local communities, local stakeholders to really adapt clean cooking solutions as per as the need of the local community. So it's well adopted among them.
Let's bring in Aaron in Peshtigo. Aaron, hi, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
I want to jump back a little bit and maybe push back against some of the comments earlier regarding livestock and animal agriculture being such an enormous source of carbon pollution. It is a pretty insignificant source, particularly in the United States. Agriculture makes up about 9% of U.S. carbon emissions, and of that, livestock agriculture is an even smaller percentage, maybe 2% of total emissions. But what really I want to drive home here is that there's a phrase I love. It's the cow, not the how. Or excuse me, it's the how, not the cow.
Mm-hmm.
Getting that backwards. So I'm a grass-fed beef farmer. I graze my cattle utilizing intensive rotational grazing management. And we're building carbon. UW-Madison's own trials they've done on my farm, they've done on numerous farms. Their long-term trials on their own Arlington farm have shown managed grazing is the only way to reliably sequester carbon in our agricultural soils. And so no amount of eating vegetables, becoming vegan or vegetarian or anything like that is going to change the climate. And these arguments about carbon intensity of beef, for example, versus other crops like grains, they're false equivalencies. You can say that it takes three times more carbon to produce a pound of beef than a pound of rice, but they're not nutritionally equivalent foods. So it's a complete red herring. It's trying to change the conversation from we need to generally decarbonize our economy, change the way that we live. Quite frankly, the amount of transportation that we utilize, the amount of energy we consume in general, and trying to scapegoat animal agriculture as being the source when it's really a very insignificant source and, if done right, can be part of the solution to climate change.
Aaron, thank you for bringing that to the table, managed grazing to sequester carbon. Paul, you first, go ahead.
Sure, and that's a good point it can be seen as it's the how and not the cow. And as what Aaron has said and experienced on his own farm is that as you are shifting how animals are raised out on the pasture is that it can build up extra amount of carbon in the soil. However, as cows are eating the grass, and even if they are building up extra carbon in the soil, as they are eating the grass, as they are breaking it down in their stomachs, then they are burping out methane. And that has a very big impact on the carbon, on the climate, even more so than carbon dioxide, especially in the first 10 or 12 years. So even a small shift in our diet or plugging the methane leaks on gas lines can have a quick and large impact on the climate. And again, what I was trying to say before is that it's not that we shouldn't eat any beef, but in America, we are certainly, and a lot of Europe, we're eating a lot more protein than our bodies actually need. Hmm. So certainly there is obviously, as Aaron said, a difference in what's in a pound of rice or a pound of beef. But there are certain places in the world that are lacking a lot of protein, and other areas where we already are consuming a lot more than is needed. So again, I think it's more of like, let's treat our meat as a treat, so not eat as much of it. And then when our pastures are managed, as opposed to in feedlot, is using the types of practices that Aaron and the growing number of farmers are starting to do again. Mm. And a lot of that was a norm up until like the mid 80s or so, as our small farms that had a mixture, at least in Wisconsin, mixture of livestock and hay.
And I want Yusuf to jump in here as well. You know, what Aaron describes as an insignificant source, and, you know, focused really on grass-fed beef cattle and managed grazing, should you be looking elsewhere in terms of trying to get to drawdown?
First of all, I'd like to add that, as Paul mentioned, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. So it's about 80 times more powerful than CO2. So for example, you know, releasing 1 kilogram of methane in the atmosphere is about equivalent to releasing 80 grams of carbon dioxide. So that's something that's very important to keep in mind, you know, that, you know, as the number of cattle, you know, increases, you know, we release more methane because, you know, they are so much more powerful, even if the quantity or the amount is low, its effect on greenhouse gas, its effect on the atmosphere is pretty high. The second aspect in, you know, across many countries, you know, forests, there is huge deforestation, and Brazil is a good example, just to, you know, provide the land for cows and cattle to graze. So that again leads to huge amount of, you know, CO2 that's being released, you know, in the atmosphere. And yes, we need to look at transportation, at our energy sources, but agriculture is in fact a big part of the greenhouse gas emissions, you know, and we need to also focus on agriculture. And as Paul mentioned, and I would like to reiterate again, you know, we are not saying that, you know, just stop consuming meat or beef completely. What we're just saying here is that the impact is well established, and we need to, you know, realign ourselves with the nature here and just eat it, you know, as a treat, you know. And in many parts of the world, you know, meat is mostly focused on, you know, when there is occasion, you know, once or twice or three times a week, you know, not in all of our meals. So it's very important that while we focus on other sectors, including transportation, including energy, we also need to focus on agriculture and how we eat and how we live to effectively bring drawdown.
Environmental scientists Yusuf Jamil, Paul West are here explaining the latest findings from Project Drawdown Lift. They're behind the Climate Poverty Connections report. Still time to talk about combining action on climate while lifting people out of poverty. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It is a conversation on climate solutions that also help address acute hunger and weather extremes, give tools and resources to adapt to the changing climate for people who've done the least to contribute to the crisis. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Project Drawdown's Climate Poverty Connections report has 28 climate actions, and we have the researchers behind the report, Yusuf Jamil and Paul West, with us for about 9 more minutes. Yusuf, Ross from Middleton called, couldn't stay with us, and Ross wanted to know if your study is geared for people trying to affect change at the individual level, or is it more geared toward corporations in control of agriculture, in control of industry?
Thank you so much. That's a great question. And I think, our report is for everyone to read and see what they can do. But more importantly, it's for people who make the change, for decision makers, for policy makers, for companies and donors to shift programmatic and funding strategies around climate and poverty solutions. So as you mentioned, our report is focused on, the people who live on less than $2 a day. So these people are the ones that are suffering the most from climate change. I'll give a quick example from a recent heat wave that happened in India. I was reading a report about a person who sells fish. She was telling that because of the heat wave, the cost of ice has gone up. So basically they put the fish on the ice to sell. So for her, procuring the ice has become more challenging now. And secondly, because of the intense heat, the ice are melting. So really, now she's losing her livelihood because of this. So, we want policymakers, we want people who fund developmental programs in developing countries for people who live basically hand to mouth to promote those solutions that can help people who are and will be most adversely impacted by climate change, to not go back into poverty and to lift them out of poverty. A good example in this case, as I was mentioning about the person who was selling the fish, is if she had access to clean electricity, she could have easily stored her fish for a longer time, and not being fearful of losing her, her source of income. So it's really important, for decision makers, again, for policy makers who work in the developmental framework, to see the challenges that are brought about by climate and implement solutions that address both climate change and poverty simultaneously.
Let's bring on Sherry in Madison. Sherry, you have experience with solar ovens in other countries.
Yes. Kate, thanks for having this show, and thank you to Project Drawdown. I had the wonderful experience to go actually with a class from Madison College to Costa Rica out in rural areas. And what we were doing is we found that there was a rural co-op. People had called in about alternate cooking, and the women there were teaching other women how to build solar ovens that they would build on a wooden frame so that you could stand up and cook. And the worst lung problems that they had was from using dung and wood in their houses. And so this was seen as both a health improvement as well as, it freed up hours and hours a day of getting alternative fuels that, were unhealthy to burn. So that is something that was going on. The other thing was putting in solar for pumps so people could get water out of clean water out of the ground. So those are some of the things that we were doing. And even putting solar, one solar panel on to light one light bulb in a room in the house so that when it got dark out, the kids in the house could still have light and read and do their homework.
Sherry, thank you for bringing this in your personal experience. Yusuf, what do you make of solar ovens, solar pumps, and the role of solar technology?
No, absolutely. All the point where something that we have mentioned in our report and I've been seeing in other part of the world. For instance, I'll give this example of solar sisters from that started in Uganda, but has since then expanded to Tanzania and Nigeria. And in these programs, you know, it's a woman-centered network where households that do not have access to clean electricity or, you know, clean cooking, you know, they're provided with rudimentary form of electricity. So like a solar lantern, solar cooking, it has been transformational, you know, households have reported almost doubling in lightning hours after sunset. About 90% of the parents in the study reported that their children's academic performance increased or improved. And most importantly, the money that was saved on kerosene, on buying kerosene to burn the lamps, were actually used on education, on buying good food, or starting a new business. So all these, you know, these small solutions can be extremely transformational for people who live, you know, on very less money, on less than $2, $3 a day. So very, very important. Same with solar, you know, solar pumps. For a lot of farmers, you know, it has changed their lives. And there have been several studies across the developing countries, you know, where access to water through solar pumps have increased the yield of the farmers. And importantly, you know, it has improved food security. They can eat better food. And, you know, in times when there is less rainfall or, you know, it's drought, they can use that water to still continue keep growing crops. So it provides them a security. And oftentimes, you know, this money that they generate, you know, which is more consistent, is used in education, in improving the housing. So all these solutions are just tremendous and then can play a huge, huge role in improving, you know, the quality of the life of the people, you know, who live on the margin and who are the least responsible for the climate change, you know, for the greenhouse gas buildup in the atmosphere that we have seen. So great point.
And Paul, in less than a minute we have left, what obligation do wealthy developed nations have to help poor countries develop in a sustainable way?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think it's a combination of things. So what we try to do in the report is show that there are certain activities or solutions that can address climate change and improve people's lives, and that there is already a lot of investment out of the World Bank, AID, and others that if funneled in certain ways can help address extreme poverty as well as climate. But certainly any activities that we are doing here in Wisconsin have an impact everywhere around the world. I mean, all of us share a climate. And what we have tried to do at Project Drawdown is say that, yes, this is a huge challenge, but we already have all the tools at hand. And that oftentimes it's not an either or, that there are a whole bunch of opportunities for win-wins.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Paul West, Special Projects Director for Project Drawdown. Yusuf Jamil, an environmental scientist, research associate with Project Drawdown, working at the intersection of climate and poverty. We have a link to their report at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.